I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurta, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
Thanks for coming out. It's another wonderful evening in Baltimore. I hope this is. Shh.
Hey. Yes. That happens.
Yes. All right.
So I hope tonight's a distraction from today's events, which I'm sure everybody was glued to. So I'm going to run home and listen to the late news, I'm sure. So thanks again for coming out. Welcome to Origins, especially for you first-timers out there, who I think there's a couple of you guys. I'm Dana Slater, one of the producers of this Origins series. And tonight we're going to continue the conversation that we started last Thursday. Who was here last Thursday? Anybody? A couple people, yeah, good. About the economic impact of buying and sourcing food locally. Last week, we heard from Scott Nash, the CEO and founder of Mom's Organic Market, and Tracy Ward, who runs a new food hub in Easton called Chesapeake Harvest. We had, I think, a very lively discussion and kind of boiled down to organic versus local, all things being equal. And I think we left a lot of questions on the table. So I think we'll continue tonight with that conversation. But we're going to look at it from the farmer's point of view. And as you've heard over and over and over at these Origins events, farming is not for the weak of heart. It is hard, hard work with enormous challenges, not the least of which is this rain. So I'm sure we'll get into more of these challenges as we discuss your businesses, each of what you do. I also want to repeat what I said last week for radio purposes, that Spike started Woodbury Kitchen and the other restaurants that make up the Food Shed Group with a commitment to local growers and producers, and he and his team deserve kudos for generating $2.1 million annually back to the local economy for the last few years.
Yeah.
So. So this is our 27th Origins event. Welcome, Mark and Dave. Really glad that you guys could come out. I know it's a very busy time of the year. It's been a horrible summer and not a great night. So thank you very much. Between Dave and Mark, they have over 50 years of experience in farming in the Mid-Atlantic area. And I think Dave actually farmed in Colorado and California as well. So maybe we'll touch on that a little bit.
Why?
So, where's that?
Why?
Why did you go east?
Why did you leave?
Yeah, exactly. Let's not go there.
So, here's a little bit on each of our panelists tonight. Mark, to my left here, is the farmer owner of Toygo Orchards in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. Mark began his career in agriculture at an early age, moving with his family from Washington, D.C., to the family's newly acquired orchard in Shippensburg. After a brief stint in the aeronautics industry, we can talk about that too, sure. Mark returned to the family farm. With expansion in mind, Mark was at the forefront of developing the farm-to-table model, which allowed rural farms to collaborate and partner together to bring their products to the urban marketplace. This program is now an extensive network of farmers markets saturating the New York City and Washington, D.C. areas. I think you're in over 10 markets. Is that right?
About 30.
30. Oh, boy. I was off.
That's over 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So Mark has multiple sales channels other than the farmers markets. I know he sells to Whole Foods, Mom's Markets, and others, right?
Correct.
Okay, good. He has a clear understanding of the marketplace, and this allows him to forecast trends and select crops that show promising yields and buyer preferences. Mark makes sustainability a top priority and has built and retrofitted facilities to reduce the negative effects commercial agriculture has on the environment. So thanks for being here, Mark. Appreciate it. And he's going to listen to some podcasts going home tonight.
I will. First time.
Dave Liker, to Spike's left, started in organic farming over 20 years ago, as I said, in both California and in high-altitude Colorado. He moved to Maryland in late 2008 to start Gorman Farms. I'm not sure where the name came from.
We're on Gorman Road.
Ah, okay. There we go. Okay. They are now in their 10th season of production. They have expanded and purchased their own farm in 2016, and are now operating off of two locations in Howard County. He grows diversified annual vegetables for a 600-plus member CSA, and I think what we'll get into tonight is he's a member-only, CSA model only is basically how you run your business.
For the most part, he does
a little bit of a pick-your-own strawberry season when we have strawberries for, like, a week.
Right.
So welcome, Dave.
Thanks. Thank you.
As always, there's a strong and committed team behind each of our Origins event, and starting with Spike, so thank you. I'd just like to take a few minutes to extend my thanks and gratitude to Lauren Paven-Jones, the general manager of Artifact Coffee, who will be moving on next week. So Lauren is a rock and is an example of grace under pressure at all times. Thank you, Lauren, for all of your involvement, encouragement, and support over the last few years. And this is the first one that she's actually sat through.
So. She hasn't made it through yet.
No, that's true. Okay. I'll miss working. Miss you very much, Lauren. And I'm hoping you. I know you'll leave this place in capable hands with Nico. And is Nico in here? I don't think so. She's out there. So welcome, Nico. Introduce yourself to Nico if you get a chance tonight. Thank you, as always, to Hannah Reagan in the back, Mary Romeo, Donnie Carlo, who's doing our recording, and the team here at Artifact. And big thanks to Lou tonight, who is cooking for us, and Spike will tell us more about the meal later. It's been a busy week for all of us. Most of you know that we record tonight's proceedings, and then we edit it and upload it as a podcast to Heritage Public Radio. So just do me a favor. I know you get excited to ask your questions, but just wait. Raise your hand, and I'll come around with the mic. Just helps us with the clarity of the recording. So even for those follow-up questions. So, so that's it. So welcome, Mark, Dave, and take it away, Spike.
Thanks, Dana. Thank you, Lauren, for all the 27 amazing origins and so much else. This is such a great conversation, and it is interesting that we're kind of coming on the heels of our conversation last week with Scott and Tracy. And I think for me, the high point of that is where Scott said, sitting here, that he thought that local was overrated. And I was able to kind of turn to Tracy and say, like, what do you think about that? And, you know, someone that was... But it's also great because we need to have these conversations around, about the food that we all care about. And I think tonight we get to hear from two folks that are working in part of the space that we just don't hear enough about, because we hear a lot about farm to table. We don't hear too much about how this important food gets from the farm to the table. And these two gentlemen have done amazing work in figuring that out. And I'm really excited that we're going to have this conversation tonight. And the fact that you're both farmers and not policy folks or whatever is going to, I think, enrich that conversation. And that's kind of where I want to start, is I want to hear about the farm operations that you guys have. And then I'd love to transition from knowing about how you grow and what you grow to, you know, the marketing that you do and how you get your products to us. So let's start with you, Mark. Known you a long time. Dave, I'm meeting for the first time tonight, but I already know that we're going to have a good time. with this conversation. Mark, I've known from, I think first from our work on the board of Fresh Farm Markets, where I really got to know you, but we've done events together since then, and I know that we have a lot in common when it comes to the food that we eat and this incredible region where we live and work. But tell us about the orchard and you know where you kind of came into it as Dana mentioned and you've taken it to amazing places.
Thanks.
Sure.
Yeah. Evening, everyone. I don't know if you can hear me in the back. Does that sound good? Yeah. So I was we were born and raised down here in Washington D.C. and my father had an idea when I was fairly young to cut the urban and biblical cord and buy a farm up in Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. It was a very rural area then. The interstate didn't even go as far as the farm did. So on the weekends and in the summer, we would head up to Pennsylvania and kind of learn how to farm. My grandfather came over from Italy. He actually had a farming background, and I think my dad wanted to kind of connect with that vision of what his father did growing grapes in Italy. Growing apples without a background in it was awfully challenging at that time. This was in the late 60s, early 70s. There was only a handful of apples being grown at that time. If you recall, probably Red Delicious, Yellow Delicious, Rome, and Stamen. Really, those were the primary apples being grown, and a handful of peaches. And at that time, you know, even the peaches were kind of a couple core varieties that just were late July and kind of August. So how things were farmed, very different than they are now with, you know, varieties and breeds that extend longer into the season. They start out shorter. And that comes into play a little bit later as we got into direct marketing. But kind of grew up in that environment on the farm. It was a tough go in the 70s for American agriculture. It has not changed a lot for core commodity growers. You get a bump every now and then, but basically you're working against the averages of risk. We continued farming. I went off to university at that time and came back, got a degree in aeronautics. Loved planes, flying, engineering, everything associated with that. I thought it was a much better space to be in, and the escapism of being around planes is natural for any kid raised on a farm. You know, when you're in a field and you see a jet fly over or something, you look up and you wonder where it's going and why the hell aren't you on it? but I came back. The economy wasn't so great, and maybe I wasn't the 4-0 I thought I was. So the job offers for Boeing weren't flowing in and things like this. But I stayed on the farm, and from there, we've kind of gotten into many different kinds of orchards. We do pear and apple. We do about 27 varieties of peaches. We raise 5 acres under glass of organic tomatoes. We do row crops, corns, grains. All in all, we probably manage about 700 acres of fruit and 40 acres of veggies, and like I said, about 5 acres of organic greenhouse. Wow. So it's a fair amount going on.
And just before, I want to talk to Dave about his farm, but I'd like for you to give us a sense of the challenges, I think, as the rain continues to come down outside, this extraordinarily challenging season, the challenges of raising tree fruit, especially in the Mid-Atlantic, because that's something... Talk about that.
Yeah, so it's Old Testament right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just raining and raining and raining, and we have two kinds of orchards. We have commercial, which you would call conventional, and we have organic production. The conventional production has fared, as you can imagine, much better in this climate this year. The applications of how you put sprays and materials on are kind of designed to withstand this amount of... It's just more effective in this climate, this bacteria, this fungal, this virus that's getting created out there. It's a petri dish every day. Rain, then it gets warm.
I think, and talk about that, because it's interesting to connect the two. We see a lot of rain.
Right.
And that affects different crops in different ways. But the challenge is especially around fruit in general, but tree fruit is tough.
It's not bred for resistance. It's bred for American flavor profiles. Crunchy, sweet, tart, red, off-center. But the disease, they try to breed as much disease resistance into it, but as you can well imagine, varieties 100 years ago had a lot of natural disease resistance that no longer exists. Notwithstanding, the American consumer has no desire to see anything that an apple would have looked like 100 years ago. We have pretty high tolerances right now. In the past, everybody can probably think about the Honeycrisp apple that they all know and love, and most everybody, that and the Gala are the number one consumed fruit. We just dumped, 6,000-7,000 bushels of them this week, which is our highest value apple that
what
we
do you
grow.
Mean, dumped,
going to the juice plant. You know, because micro cracking, just from the amount of moisture in the soil, the tree continues to absorb the fruit, and it just exceeds its skin's capacity to grow. So it cracks and stretches, and just makes a big mess. There's probably not you're not going to find a commercial Honeycrisp in the Mid-Atlantic this year. The whole crop's gone, just due to rain. Just lots of it.
Is that because that specific variety is not doesn't do well with?
It doesn't do well in this climate to begin with. It, uh-huh. You know, it's a Minnesota bred apple,
right?
And we thought, well, that's what consumers want, so we're going to try to grow it. And it's tough to grow in any given year. It's a finicky thing, uh-huh. And weather like this, which we've had 27 inches, and a month and a half. It's just there's no tolerance for such things out there in the orchard. Yeah.
So now. What a great lead-in.
Yeah.
The rain.
I can talk about rotten
down.
Crops as long as you want.
Yeah. And I guess it's same in Howard County, right?
Yeah, you bet. You bet. I stopped tracking the inches a while ago.
Oh. Sibilance check.
Yeah.
But tell us about the farm, and as Dana said, you kind of came from out of state, and
yeah, I have
interesting
a
choice, but
yeah, it is.
In this,
it is. I have a fairly unconventional story. I grew up in Southern California and did a lot of different things before farming. I do not come from a farming background whatsoever. I'm very much the black sheep in the family. I have a very city-based family. Grew up in the city, and I worked as a musician and was a semi-professional musician for a while. And so, in between doing some recordings, I needed to get be able to pay the bills and pay rent. So I started working on a small organic farm, which is where I really kind of fell in love with what was going on and the culture there.
Where was that?
In Santa Barbara. So I started managing a small produce, a little roadside farm, and the produce in Santa Barbara, let alone California, there's a little microclimate there. You can grow bananas and guavas. It's basically Mediterranean / Central American.
That is not for importation. It's just we're just trying to get you to talk to the
Oh, can you guys hear back there? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah,
cool.
This is for the recording.
Okay.
So
gotcha. Gotcha. Anyways, yeah, I fell in love with the culture and started growing gardens. I became like instantly a just completely obsessed market gardener. Was tearing up every house I had and started growing things. And then I moved to Colorado and lived at about 9,500 feet. And tried growing out there, and I was actually quite successful compared to others at it, and was doing farmers markets and things. And that was a really tough climate because you have snow in June and you have snow in September. So we did pretty good with that. And then,
what were you able to grow in Colorado?
Mostly things you grow in winter here, for the most part, at that altitude. A lot of greens, a lot of root crops, and I still planted a little bit of sweet corn and beans, and you'd get them on one day, and then the snow would come. I had a little greenhouse there. I mean, it was just a novelty kind of hobby situation. And then when I met my wife, we moved back here because her family was here, and we found a farming opportunity in upstate New York, and that was kind of the catalyst to pull us here. It was one of these turnkey farming situations. And it was way up in upstate New York. It was just beautiful, and we flew out to take a look at it, and we found that all the infrastructure was wrong, the equipment was wrong, the scale was off, the distance to market was off. We didn't really understand that too much, but we were really excited by it. The price was dirt cheap for a lot of land, and it was kind of a dreamy thing to do, and we had just gotten married. And we stumbled upon Joan and Drew Norman at One Straw, just uh-huh. on a visit out here,
uh-huh.
And saw what they were doing and saw their model. They were a big part of our startup just by seeing them. And you know, I think you guys know them. And
sure.
Very inspirational people, and have become good friends of ours. And so I really found a model, and my wife's family was here. And we just had great connection to family. And so we spent about 2 years looking for ground out in this area. We drove all over Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and we settled in Howard County. To a lot of people's advice was, you know, farm where there's a market, kind of contrary to farm where the soils are good. So we started our business, and we wanted to do a CSA model. We started with 30 members, and instantly we were a huge success. We got a ton of press. We had we're about a mile off of 95, and we're in Columbia, basically. And there's really nothing like that where we are. We barely have any topsoil on that farm. It's a very difficult farm. The topography is difficult, but we had a phenomenal market. And so the business just kind of took off, and we were able to scale up pretty quickly, and a lot of headaches and heartaches through all that. So 2 years ago, we purchased a farm in the same county, just a few miles away. And throughout that time, we had four children, so a lot of things were changing in life and whatnot and dynamics. But we were concerned because we've been on leased ground, so we wanted to make sure we could maintain what it was we had and be able to stabilize that into the future. And here we are 2 years later, and so we're operating out of both locations.
Uh-huh. How many acres in total?
So we're on 20. We have 56 that we run. Half of that is in hay that is now coming back into our management. So we've got about 25 to 40 over at the original location. We just purchased 82, of which 20 is in crops. Another 20 is coming into production. We have another 20 in hay. And we have that kind of ideal. I have that idealistic view of having a particular portion of land out of production, and we'll move into it and we'll rotate through it, but it never really works out that way. So we just got this. We bought an old dairy farm, a dilapidated dairy farm. It took us basically 2 years to clean it up. It was just tractor trailer loads of just junk and old fertilizer tanks and grain bins that are falling down. And so that brought us to here. And we farm. We do a 600-plus member CSA. We used to do farmers markets. We did wholesale. We did restaurants over the years. We do a pick-your-own-strawberry venture. But we've come all the way back to doing 100% CSA and a little bit of pick-your-own. It's been a really great change for us.
So let's just... Well, first, talk about the crops that you're growing.
Mm-hmm. We do diversified annual vegetables, pretty much no perennials right now, with the exception of strawberries, but we grow them like an annual. And we do about 40 different types of vegetables, about 100 to 110 varieties every year. It just depends on the season. I've definitely, my zest for that has gotten a big reality check. I used to try to grow 10 different kinds of melons every single year, but I've learned the varieties that do work and the performances that we need to economically run our business, and I've had to back off that. And that's, you know, the wintertime illusions of, oh, I'm going to grow this, and going through those seed catalogs.
Seed catalogs.
Right? Yeah, they're candy, and they're addicting, and you got to be real careful with those. The seed catalogs are dangerous.
So what's the season been like with all this?
Terrible. It's the worst season we've ever had.
I haven't found a farmer who hasn't said that.
No. I mean,
you can go back as many years as you can.
We're losing crops right and left, and I think the tragedy of it is we're losing them right at harvest. So we just lost this week our second crop of broccoli. We do several rotations in fall.
We lost
it to rot, basically. So you're seeing degradation. You're seeing plant disease, as Mark's talking about, all over the place. And in organics, we get a lot of plant disease. And I grow annuals, and it's a short life. It's a lot different when his type of production, which is a perennial or a tree fruit that's lasting for years and years. So I've learned some of the diseases and some of the pest issues that I used to freak out about and really battle and put a lot of effort and money into. But I know how they're going to persist. I know when I can treat them. I know when to hit bugs when they're at the right stage, when to let go, when to back off. And that makes a big difference economically. It makes a big difference emotionally and for the morale of the farm. But in a year like this, you're seeing that and you know what's coming. And I think the difficult thing is thinking, we've been through so much, we've got to get a break. And we just have not had a break. And that's what's just tragic. And every week rolls around, you go, well, maybe next week we will. Well, maybe next week. I mean, right now my hands are kind of up in the... To me, it's hilarious at this point. I mean, what else are you going to do? You've cried enough. You've tried to talk to your customers enough about it, but there's really not much you can do. We still in organics. We still do a lot of spraying. It's just in a nutshell, the potency is less effective. Sometimes the intervals have to be a little bit more frequent. And for the most part, it's less effective. We don't have as many tools in the toolkit when it comes to spraying in order to meet some of the challenges.
We're spraying for
bugs and we're spraying for fungal issues for the most part. So organic pesticides and organic fungicides in order to treat crops. And that's on a regular basis. And I would say this year I've been more religious about it than any other year. And so it's kind of double the pain because you put that money into those, you put that time into those. In the broccoli, for instance, which is my killer because it's a heavy nitrogen user. To me, it's a staple crop that I feel like my customers, they really want. Everybody loves broccoli. They know what to do with it. I can grow turnips and radishes till the cows come home, but you know, a guy like you is going to make a beautiful plate of turnips, but the layman, they don't really know what to do with them. So you give them broccoli, you give them carrots, you give them that type of things, and it really satisfies. We've really learned over the years what's a home run for the customers versus what's not. But I'm thankful for the redundancy that we do put into our production because in a year like this, I feel like I get criticized a lot because I grow so much. I grow so much variety and I grow so much quantity. Our CSA is extremely bountiful and has been highly consistent. I'm always questioning that in winter when I'm doing my planning. You know, can I back off? But I want to have that redundancy in my production. And had I not had that redundancy in my production, this year would have been a towel thrown in, business closing, you know, tell 600 families, which is really, I think we have over 1,100 people on our email list that goes out to the newsletter every week, to tell them, I'm sorry, we're done. And we still have crops. I mean, we're still giving that. I feel like our customers are still fairly satisfied. I'm probably the worst judge of that, but I am seeing the crop failures on a day to day. We've lost spinach 5 times. We've lost carrots 2. We've lost broccoli 2 or 3 times. We're losing lettuce right and left in fields that are abnormal on a year like this. It's a killer. And we're in new ground too. So we've been expanding every year. I'd say I've only had maybe 1 or 2 years where the ground I'm cropping, I know that ground really well. So we're on a new farm. I'm on new ground. I did produce there last year, but I'm into production zones that I wasn't in, and I have wet spots, and you know, we've put in waterways and done these different things, but it's extremely challenging. And some of the ground I was in last year, I knew it performed poorly during the rains, but in a year like this, and it's fast. I mean, at noon, the guys are out in the field, and things are looking good, and I'm worried about it. I've been worried about carrots, watching those tops drop. I'm telling my field crew leader, watch those tops. And by 2 o'clock, 50% of the field, it was fine at noon, and 50% of the field, the tops are dropping, which means the carrots are rotting because they're this deep, and the water table's, you know, this far from the top of the soil. So I know that's going to happen. I know what to expect from it. So it's challenging. It's a depressing field walk, right? And vegetables right now. It's just
a great business model.
Yeah. Let's just go hit the bar at this point.
Yeah. I can bitch for a long time about vegetable production this year. You can ask my staff. You can ask anybody. I'm just kind of, I mean, I can barely walk through the fields right now. It's just depressing. And I feel bad for my crew, the morale for those guys that are putting in that kind of backbreaking work.
Right.
You know. But I'm talking to everybody. I talk to a lot of vegetable farmers, and it's kind of a relief. I talked to a guy just recently, and he's having the same thing. And then we had a heat wave a couple weeks ago where it was hot for a long time, and we went super dry. And that was really, really stressful on the crops as well. That was really stressful. We're so far behind in field work. You're trying to play catch-up that all these things that you need to do, you couldn't do. Powdery mildew wiped out winter squash in a couple days, and crops are sitting out in full sun. We lost thousands of squashes to sunburn.
So like a
sunburn because the canopy's not shading the crop, and so it's sitting there. And it was almost 100 degrees where we were for 2 solid weeks. It never broke. 95, 96 degrees all day. And I have fruits sitting out there. We're so far behind, just trying to play catch up. So,
what is the soil like on your farm right now? That you're coming into
right now,
or that you mentioned that the soil wasn't great.
So that's part of the depression in the whole thing is the soils we're on now are much stronger. I think the original farm we were on, a lot of the topsoil had been scraped off, and there wasn't much to begin with. It had been conventionally farmed for a really, really long time. And the new soils we're on, the aggregates, it's a lot looser. It's a little bit more sandy. We've been in really, really heavy clay. And a heavy clay down low, then that plow layer has been pulled in and merged on our old farm. So the new farm is, it's really been a dream for me. We drag a lot of metal through the dirt with a lot of different pieces of equipment, and there's nothing uniform about it at the original farm. You're adjusting your equipment all the time. In vegetables, you're not doing long passes the way you are in kind of row crop farming, so it's a lot of turning around and short, quick moves, and when you have to get off and adjust pretty much in every row, it kind of makes you go nanners a little bit. So this new farm has been great. Some of the processes that we need to do if you're out there doing passes for a couple hours, to be able to put the headphones on and like watch the birds and zone out a little bit on redundant moves is just been a dream for me. So this year I was so excited to work this ground, and our about 98% of my production moved to the new farm, and in my soul, I was ecstatic because I was like, we're going to work good ground and the plastic's going to lay well and the bedding's going to be nice and the weeding's going to be nice. And we're not working ground right now. We're not working ground right now. Yeah, we haven't been working ground all season. So
we'll try to leave the rain behind and talk about
happiness.
Well, what we're here to talk about. And it's interesting you brought up Joan and Drew at One Straw, because they have one of the strongest, I think, most successful CSAs that I'm aware of. And that seems to be the model that you've kind of settled on. And it's a model, you know, first I want you to talk about what a CSA is. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of folks here that I'm sure totally get that, but this is going to go out there. And what we try to do at Origins is really talk about everything in as much detail and as kind of concretely as we can. And I think CSA is something that it is in our kind of understanding of farm to table, and it's something we feel good about, but it's something, a model that also has a lot of challenges. But first talk about
CSA?
What a CSA is, and your CSA particular.
CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and in a nutshell, it's kind of a subscription program where your members that buy into the farm, they pay in advance for the produce, and then they come and pick it up. More traditionally, people will come and pick up a box of produce that the farm would aggregate their harvest from and put it together. I think originally CSA came from the community was actually providing the support for the farm, and the farm was able to stay viable based on that community support by bringing in the income in the beginning of the season when the expenses and the costs are the most challenging. Not a lot of farms have a lot of capital left over from the season before. So in our model, it's a lot different because we are very much in the city. We don't have to pack a box. Nowadays, CSA has become very popular. It's become very trendy. And so a lot of farms are doing that as one portion of their marketing. They may be doing wholesale, they may be doing farmers markets, but they also offer a CSA. It's a fantastic outlet. In our case, we are relying pretty much 100% on the CSA for our income annually. And it's the same thing for us because we weren't capital intensive, or we didn't have that. We need to bring that money in the beginning of the season when the labor costs are high, the expenses are high, and then, you know, it's a very interesting business model because you don't have the traditional cash flow that most businesses do. We kind of bring it all in at once, and then we have to just be really careful as we get towards the end of the season. And in our model, different than most models is the way that I realized we had the opportunity to is we set it up like a farmer's market on site at our farm. So our members actually come to the farm. We don't move any of the produce off of the farm. That was something I was very adamant about in the very beginning, is I did not want to move product off the farm myself. If anybody wanted to come in and take it, they could, because it's very expensive to do so. And so they come in. In a nutshell, we set it up like a farmer's market, and then they come, and we have chalkboards, and we delegate what it is they can have. And as we've grown that model over time and we've weaned ourselves out of wholesale and out of farmers markets and out of restaurant sales, basically our whole farm is geared towards that. And so my production is geared towards that. My whole cropping plan is geared towards that. And we've really been able to hone in on, I think, what it is that people want. And we get to see and actually talk to our customers. I don't as much anymore, but I used to be present on the farm all the time. And we communicate through surveys, and we try to make it as flexible as a program as possible. So CSAs, there's a very diverse range of them and how they operate. And we've just kind of found something that really works for us. It's very much a niche where we are and in the style in which we do it.
So talk about what do you pay and what do you get?
So our CSA, I think, is around $800 for, we have two size shares, one we call a full, one we call a medium. A medium is about 75% of the quantity is a full. We delegate it by the number of items, but that has everything to do with the harvest. So in the early days, I was following a lot of other people's models of, you know, a full share would get 8 items, and an item I call basically a purchasable portion or a usable portion. So if it was carrots, it would be a bunch of carrots. If it was tomatoes, it might be a pint or a quart of tomatoes. But then when you come into peppers and even the tomato season, we have 10 to 20 different types of those things. So you might get a little pint of cherry tomatoes. When it's the full glut of tomatoes, you might get a little bit of Romas, a little bit of round reds, a head of lettuce or things. And so, like I said in the past, I've cut out doing things like salad greens and baby mixes and those things that are labor intensive. And I don't really grow anything but heads of lettuce when it comes to that. I bunch my arugula, and I've been able to gear the efficiencies of the field production, where a lot of the cost of our labor is, to work that into the CSA model. We grow a lot of stuff on the raised plastic mold beds. So for the most part, our produce is incredibly clean when it comes out. There's not a lot of washing that needs to take place, exception of a year like this. Mm-hmm. I was really adamant about, I wanted to go from the fields basically right to the same basket that the customer was going to pull from, and reduce as much handling as we possibly mm-hmm. can. So it fits for the customer really well, but it also fits for the economics of what we do. And in farming, that's a separate discussion, but there's the economies of scale are kind of all over the place. So we're a much smaller operation than what Mark's doing. And we would really have to be at a much different scale if we were to get into wholesale and do other types of things. So we've really been trying to like find where that sweet spot is, and you kind of think you're there, and then ta-da, you know, a year like this happens or something. Right. So we give about anywhere from 8 to maybe 15 items for a full share. And we had up to like 10 pounds of tomatoes 1 week. And so
you get that every week.
Well, as tomatoes are first coming on, you might get 1 pound.
Well, I'm saying the share you get every week.
Yeah. Sorry. So it starts in June, and it runs till middle of October, sometimes early November. This year, we're initiating a pilot program going into great year to start a winter CSA. where we'll stop in the middle of October, and then that new program will start and go up into December. So it's about 20 to 22 weeks. I used to do 24 weeks. I think 1 year I did 26 weeks, and I didn't need to. It was the same economics. I just basically beat up the field crew, running even longer when everybody's tired at the end of the season. So it's the customers love it, but CSA is really for a particular person, and we've promoted that the whole time, and I think that's been a big part of our success, is we're not trying to rope everybody in. Because if you're the type of person that's picky about vegetables, you don't cook at home, you eat out a lot, you're a professional out in the city, and you don't have the time to do that, or that's not for you, this is not the program for you. And we say that all over the website. We say that in our marketing. I have conversations with people all the time. They're like, oh, we heard your CSA is so great, and you have a long waiting list, and we really want in, but my husband doesn't like spinach and carrots and broccoli and beets and tomatoes. And I'm like, yeah, you don't want to be a part of this. You know, it's you know, and they're like, what kind of apples and peaches and things are we going to get? And I said, you're not going to get any, because we only provide our CSA. A lot of CSAs aggregate food in from others, and they bring in breads and pies and honey and teas and soaps and all these different things. We are 100%, the CSA is kind of back to the true model, where it is supporting the farm. We only give in our CSA distributions what we grow and what we provide. Except we do have bees on site, and I have a beekeeper who does the honey, but the honey that goes into the CSA comes from that. And I explored a lot. I've sold Mark's fruit. We had a farm stand for years, and we had sweet corn, and we did pumpkins and Christmas trees, and we did a lot of the common kind of agrotouristic things, a lot of the farm stand types of things. I never really merged that into my CSA. I always kept it separate, but we did have an on-site store for many, many years. It was very popular. And I closed that a few years ago to just keep simplifying. A farm is so many moving parts, and it's so easy to get into this and get into that. And in our case, it was just an explosion, because we were in the city and we had so much demand, and we had people coming down, and we had full parking lots. And we were total rookies at it. Like I said, I did not come from a farming family, so it was just kind of like, wow, this is a tractor, and what does this do? And you know, we exploded really, really fast. So we've kind of had to streamline.
So we go from the CSA model. You don't do it. Do you do a CSA at all?
We don't do a CSA. No.
And you found most of your success in direct marketing, what most of us would call farmers markets, right?
Pretty much.
And then into supermarkets.
So we started actually selling through wholesalers. We'd sell to, you know, down where Union Market is now, there used to be a bunch of just old Greeks and Jewish guys and Italian guys, and you took everything to them, and they broke it up and had their own little distribution mobs they sold them to, and we didn't know what we were going to get paid for it. And it wasn't really a great business model, but it worked for food distribution because the farmer really never had a good connection or had the ability to put wheels underneath product of where it was going to go. That was kind of the one model we were into, and then we also sold into packing houses. That's where you just basically pick everything, send it off to someone who runs equipment, puts it in boxes, and then sells it to someone who you don't know. It's a very disconnect, and the local scene at all had no traction whatsoever. Uh-huh. There was no absolute desire. Actually, contraire, you know, you'd be growing whatever we grew. Everybody put you up against what was happening in Washington State. Or, oh, if you don't have a tomato, we want Jersey tomatoes, or we want Florida, you know, the cello-pack. Can you cello-pack tomatoes, if you remember those kind of six-by-six things? Everything people wanted, we really didn't have the ability to provide. So from being in our farm environment, and what I won't say we were a monocrop, meaning we only had one or two crops, we didn't have a lot of diversity in what we did. And when I got back, one of the things that was interesting, or at least I don't know how you consider it beneficial at the time, and I guess it has been, when I was in university, I went to work in a restaurant, and that's kind of where I worked, and I was, you know, the dishwasher and the prep cook guy kid in the back. And I worked for a CIA chef, and he was a pretty trendy dude, and he was really getting into the fusion. This was in Florida. And he always just totally bitched about produce. Like, they couldn't get what he wanted. He knew he was missing the real sweet spot for the prime harvest of everything, mangoes or tomatoes or whatnot. And I, you know, I let him know that I came off farm, and we talked about produce a lot, and I, you know, trying to explain to someone who lived in Florida what a tree ripened peach is like is difficult. It's like trying to explain to someone up here what a mango is like. You know, it's a very different eating experience. And when I got out of school, again, as I mentioned, I was unemployed for a while, but I had access to some food, and so we started taking it down to the restaurants in D.C. Mm-hmm. Riss Lacoste, she was at Kincaid's, Boobin, at that time was kicking, and there were some great chefs. I didn't know how to get around. I didn't know how to do any of this, and really, it was kind of foolish. We just loaded up what you had, put it in a truck, drove around, knocked on doors, and the chefs would come out. Some of them would really trip out, you know? I mean, like, the Mayflower had a bunch of French chefs, and they would come out, and they would just tear your truck apart, picking everything they wanted. But they hadn't seen that since they were in Europe. And believe me, this was no vision of mine. I didn't think that I was doing anything other than trying to sell some produce.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then I got introduced to some great people here in the Baltimore, D.C. area, and they were buying produce out of the truck. But it was highly there was difficult ways to communicate. I didn't know what I could sell, and you didn't want to give everything to one place because you wanted to make four or five stops and give everybody a little bit, but that wasn't always the case. And it worked out really well, except I never got paid a lot for the effort, and a lot of the restaurants never paid you at all. You got a lot of double parking tickets, and you came home, and it was a long day because you drove all the way down to Washington, and You exhausted yourself trying to empty a truck to come back to start at the farm the next day to come down another day. It had its benefits. I mean, I ate well. They did. You know, all the chefs would bring in, but what hadn't really started with local at all at that point.
Right.
Just about that time, there was a couple farmers markets that I learned about, and we took some strawberries down to one of them, and people were blown away that they could just seriously underpriced myself. And we set up, you know, tables and tables of strawberries and sold them for a dollar quart or something. And you sold out, and I was like, well, God, we got a lot more of these back home. And so we'd go back and get more. So we started to get a feel that there was a need for some local, but it wasn't at all whatsoever trendy. There was no movement. There was no people didn't want to connect. They just simply liked the food.
Mm-hmm.
They liked the freshness. They certainly liked meeting you and spending the time. But it was very early on. And shortly thereafter, I think the next couple seasons, I got into some decent farmers markets in the area, you know, like Arlington, DuPont, not DuPont, excuse me, Tacoma Park, a lot of hippies, turnips, and people really liked that stuff. But that's all we had. But it was a very limited season. And it started in June, and it was done in, you know, first week of October.
Mm-hmm.
So you had an awful long season in between, and you didn't really make enough to carry you. So you're trying to figure out ways to get it done again. Fortunately, over time, the farmers market movement really started to take off. And we were fortunate. Most of the guys that I knew who farmed did not want to get up at 3 in the morning on a Friday or a Saturday or a Sunday and go to D.C. and sell all day, then come home, go back out to the fields, work, pick, go through it all, load the trucks back up, and go back down. It was surprising because we actually were able to find a fair amount of help. And mostly we found help with people down at the market area who wanted to jump in
right.
and help us. They felt
right.
we were pathetic. You know, they just really knew we needed help because we just didn't have our act together whatsoever. Over a few years that the movement really took off, I think we as growers started to really understand we needed more varieties, we needed better varieties. You did hear from people, you know, why are we eating Red Delicious? I mean, I got beat up all the time on that. We started planting other varieties, getting into much more flavor profiles, getting into more exotics, I think you would call them, from a fruit-growing perspective. We get into more stone fruits, more small fruits, very difficult to grow. You know, not a cherry, but have about 7 varieties of cherries. You know, we get into apricots and multiple varieties of apricots. Very difficult, and we didn't always have crops. I mean, they got froze out a lot. There's a reason why nobody commercially grows them here. You put them in the ground, but they don't really grow. But we started to really get feedback from people, and that, I think, was important because people over time really started to tell you about what they wanted, what they liked. And at that time, you know, the grocery stores in the area were very limited. The corner store was gone, and all you had really was Safeway and Giant, you know, in this area. And they didn't support local at that time.
Right.
And we were able to connect really well with consumers, and we were able to listen. So, I mean, all the information we heard, we were able to go back and say, well, next year, this is try this. Next year, let's try this. But the fact that people were able to feedback, they wanted to know how their food was produced, what's on it, how come it does this, we just connected with. And so it was a great education for them and to the horticultural world. And it was a great understanding for us, really, what people wanted. And it took time because it's a slow process. Every year you just try to do more and more and you try to get better at it, but it's very slow. It's not like IT or something where you can go, hey, I got it. Let's change it and pull an all-nighter and you've got the next best thing.
Right.
It took years. And at that point, we started seeing some economic upturn and markets were opening. And, you know, next thing you know, we were jumping in trucks and going to New York and the green markets. Because they didn't have a market on Sunday, and we had another guy that we hired, and we were running around like lunatics. I mean, absolute just lunatics. Because we finally started to figure out, well, we could possibly make a living, but we only had a certain amount of time. So we were kind of, you know, like squirrels with our nuts.
You mean seasonally? Or?
Seasonally,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right,
I mean, you know what the alternative to what it is you're doing isn't sustainable. And I don't mean sustainable in health or sustainable. I mean financially,
right.
Lifestyle, waking up the next day and having people who get up and work next to you,
right.
You know, because, you know, the culture of small farming in traditional America is fairly brutal in its existence of you don't know what you're going to get. And that model, nobody who has their eyes open would go into it. You almost have to be beaten into that model and exist for that time period.
It's for crazy people.
You hope for the best. What's that?
It's for crazy people.
It is. It is. Yeah, I mean, you turn to the bottle.
Yeah.
You will. I mean, it's just...
Cheers.
But you're doing it.
We're doing it.
And in spite of, you know...
This year's exceptional,
right.
I mean, in terms of difficulty. I mean, last year we had a pretty good year. We put out a lot, you know, at least in direct markets, we put out a lot more than what we need. We found ancillary markets for the products we grow. So, you know, if we're not making a fresh market for either wholesale markets, we're in the farmers markets ourselves.
Right.
Then we have a canning market that we put canned product into. And then we got into the juice business. So we tried to become
bold. By juice business, do you mean cider?
Cider.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sweet cider, not the hard cider
right,
business.
Right. Right.
So we tried to become fully integrated or vertically integrated, which is not a really good classic business model because you don't necessarily run each one of your integrations most efficiently.
Right.
But in agriculture, it's probably a very good model because you do find ways to put everything to use. And
you're also getting the return on that value when you take an apple and make it into cider.
Right. That's right. And from that full vertical integration, we were able to extend our season, keep people working longer. We were able to get rid of our traditional labor force. We grew up in the migratory labor force. I always thought that was just a hellhole of a place to be. So we were able to get rid of that, get into having more year-round people working with us. People who make a living working on the farm all the time, making a good living some years better than others, like all of us. But we didn't have that mashed up labor force. We didn't have a mashed up seasonality,
mm-hmm.
the cash flow, all these kind of – each one of these silos is a dysfunction that come together as what a farm can be. You know.
Sounds like a dream, right?
It is. Such a dream. I know at least two farms for sale here at this panel. Yeah. So, no, I'm just kidding.
I know a couple of restaurants that are for sale.
Yeah.
But you eventually found your way into supermarkets, right?
We did.
And your fruit is in supermarkets.
We are.
Which ones?
We're into Whole Foods and Ahold, which is Giant Food.
Right.
And then our juices are all over the Mid-Atlantic. We sell into Walmart, Food Lion, Giant, which is now Delhaize, which is... Food Lion and Giant Food, Weiss Markets, which is mostly up in our area.
And your fruit, if we see would I know that it's your apple?
No, we don't. We would sell mostly to a packer like a Rice Fruit, which is up in our area, a large aggregator of fruit, and they repack. The technology required anymore behind apple storage is pretty sophisticated. They were able to pick an apple at a certain pressure, at a certain Brix, which is sugar. Mm-hmm. They're able to stabilize it, and we're able to keep that apple on the consumer shelf or when they need to take it out almost until March, April. And then now these same packers are bringing in Southern Hemisphere fruit to keep their lines working, and they keep their contracts with the chain stores open year-round.
Between you and fruit from elsewhere?
We don't participate into New Zealand. We're half of the deal.
Right.
And then these packers work with Southern Hemisphere growers to keep programs because buyers have gotten much more sophisticated. They become more consolidated, right? So if you look at the grocery chains, they've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. The mom and pops are completely gone for the most part, and they become nationalized. So when they need – merchandisers need product that looks the same in all of their stores. And there's no way to do that if they're working with smaller, independent, or even relatively large farms.
Right.
The merchandisers can't handle it. So if you go into pick Aldi or pick any chain you go to, you will see a commonality between all of these fruits and vegetables or bologna or whatever you see. And that takes a lot of strategic logistics to get that happening, to make that consumer know that's what they expect to see when they go to that store every time.
Every time.
Every time. All as opposed year. To the March, old November. The old Greek and Jewish guy in the corner that had whatever
was good.
Whatever came into the corner store. Right?
So do you have a direct relationship with any supermarket?
We do. With Whole Foods. I mean, with most of the Mid-Atlantic retailers. But apples is one thing. Produce and tomatoes, things like that, we deal directly with them.
With, like, Whole Foods?
Yes, correct.
So would I see a Toygo
tomato.
Apple?
No. Unless some of the smaller, like some of the stores have a DSD store
door.
That's a local delivery into that store if they want one. And we've been dealing with them for a long time that way. And we still have some stores that we drop off locally. It's become less and less as the stores have changed from a regional market back into a national market profile again.
And the tomatoes you mentioned earlier, you said it was quick. But if you didn't catch it, 5 acres of tomatoes under glass.
It is.
That's a massive amount.
That's a big project.
And these are tomatoes that are making their way into supermarkets.
So, we go into what are called DC distribution centers. We ship directly from our property to their stores. It's a spoken hub kind of scenario. Their trucks pick up at our place, and then they go out to their stores. Mostly down in this area, mostly all Whole Foods in the Mid-Atlantic, and up an area we got a couple smaller guys.
Are those making their way into Whole Foods 12 months out of the year?
Or? No, we can't because it's organic. As much as I would love to, we have to have a pathogen break. If you would, we need to stop. We have to pull the crop, rotate, rework the soil in there. We got to clean the place up, do a lot of preventative maintenance. A lot of greenhouse came out of, you were able to interplant, intercrop, but you had a lot of, as they would say, a lot of tools in the box to work with to keep those diseases down. We don't have quite that much to work with.
Right.
So we use a lot of biocontrols and a lot of biofungicides.
So when is your break? Is it summer? Is it now? And then you?
No, we'll pull through till about, we'll pull the crop around Thanksgiving, a little bit after. And we've already picked our seeds out for next year. And they'll get propagated on a different farm. We'll pull all of our crop out, clean the facility out. We'll enrich the soil, amend it in some ways, work it, change a lot of our trip line, feeder tubes, plastics that we use.
Wow.
And then we'll plug the plants right back into it. And then 8-10 weeks out, we're back into production. So we're down for two months and change from production there
between Thanksgiving.
We'll plant around mid-December, and we'll be harvesting late February, early March.
What are you growing? Is it just a red tomato or
heirlooms? We grow about 15 kinds of heirlooms.
Wow.
So challenging. We got into the TOV market, the tomato on vine, which was really popular. Then the Mexican market came alive. They learned how to do it organically, allegedly. And they went from a very small acreage into massive acreage, and that whole market just got flooded. So what was a viable market fell through the
On vine market.
Yeah, the on vine market was there, and it disappeared. So we'd been playing around heirlooms for years, forever, for a long time, and we thought we could do them better. They're challenging. I mean, they don't fruit. I mean, the F1s or the hybrids that we have in the TOVs, just click them off. Every week you get another truss. They're just harvesting beauty. Heirlooms are particular. They eat well. They taste good. They look great. But they're just difficult to grow. I mean, they blossom abort. They don't do well in low-level lighting. Everything that could go wrong goes wrong with them. But the demand for them is incredible. But there's no supply to feed that demand. You know, even by us, who kind of grow a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I go back, Dave, CSA is a that works for you. It doesn't work for a lot of growers. And I know a lot of growers that have gotten into it and gotten out of it. Mm-hmm. Why do you think, what is it about that you do that's made CSA a successful?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're always evaluating that. I think a lot of it has to do with our location and our logistics. Based on that, so we are surrounded by suburbia, and we're surrounded by people that would otherwise have a very difficult ability to have a connection to a farm. And with that mass of people, there's going to be these people that I said that CSA works for. You have a large population. There's going to be a percentage, whether that's large or small, of people who enjoy good food, who enjoy eating at home, who enjoy cooking for their families, and who appreciate the things that we're all talking about here. And we are in Colombia. I mean, there's millions of people all the way around us. And it was interesting this last season we were doing – We're doing marketing for the first time. I've pretty much always been word of mouth. And we did a little bit of marketing to kind of see what that would be as we were looking at expanding and what our potential for scaling up would be. And I really thought that through surveys and things that our audience was a lot further away. So we did a zip code search and aggregated that data. And everybody is so unbelievably close to the farm. And we're actually, our mailing address is Laurel, Maryland, which is right on the border of Eastern Howard County and PG County. Howard County being a very affluent county and PG County being not so affluent, Prince George's County. And so it was really interesting to find out that almost everybody is coming from the Laurel area. I was just had assumed that people were coming from Ellicott City and Columbia, if you guys kind of know this area regionally, just based on what our market is and based on the BMWs and the Land Rovers and the cars that, you know, bang their oil pans as they come down my bumpy driveway. And it's really interesting. And so there's that population, I think, that makes it work. But I think also the way in which we distribute that, I think that people, I know that people really love the on-farm experience. When they come into the farm, they see and witness a farm. So they see a wagon with guys driving in and bins of watermelons on them. They see pallets of onions moving back and forth. They see and they witness that experience. And most of these people, I think, you know, a big percentage are moms that are coming. They're also coming with kids. We've tried to create an environment, as we had a retail environment as well for years, that welcomes them to that. And so a lot of people hang out. We have a couple picnic tables and things, and that's something that my staff and I have been talking about, of encouraging that even more to really enhance that experience. And we love seeing that. Much, much different than in the retail world, where people loiter on your property and cause you problems that are costly and things, and they just buy one tomato for $1.69 and then come back and return it and want a credit card charge back because there was a worm and all the headaches that are involved with retail. So it's really interesting. I think also, as we realize that quickly, the way in which we set it up and the way in which we administer the program for us is a lot different, and we have that ability because we're on site, so we can do a lot more. When we used to do farmers markets, when I used to do retail, the amount of staff that I had, the amount of logistics and policy and charts and all the things to pull off a day to day, we're able to administer a lot of produce. And for the most part, we're able to do that all with one person. Now, we've created a little bit of redundancy there just recently, but for years I've been able to do that and grow with just, for the most part, one person. To get rid of the same amount of product is it used to take 4 and 5 people to do. It's a huge, huge part to the economics of what we do. But I think from the customer experience, what's really great about that is kind of the lackadaisical thing. They're coming into a farmer's market like environment. They get to really see the product, which is much different. When you go and pick up at a church or at a grocery store or a community center and you're picking up your CSA box, a wax box. You get home and there's that wow factor of pulling it all out. But if it's kind of an off week, it's kind of like, sweet, more radishes and like more turnips. And, you know, I hope the newsletter says something nice. When they come in for us, we're set up kind of like.
They're kind of shopping a little bit.
Yeah, they're kind of shopping. And we've had to, because we've gotten bigger, we no longer can build the cascading display of carrots. The carrots are in the bulk bins with 500 bunches in them at a time. So that's changed a little bit, but they're still doing that. And the kids are able to see it and they're still getting that farm feel. So we've taken an old hay barn, or an old animal barn that's timber framed. It's got a beautiful aesthetic like this room. It was my shop for a while with the groundhogs and the snakes and all that. And we poured a concrete floor and just kind of solidified it enough that it wouldn't come down in the 40-mile-an-hour winds. And that's been fantastic. They're coming in. It's got this great ambiance. It's on the farm. They're seeing the fields or the weeds this year. And I think that has a really, really big part of what we're doing. So when we participate in a lot of speaking at conferences about CSAs and participating in those types of events, we're kind of an anomaly in that. that were a lot different than other farms that are maybe in the location where you are that would have to pack Sprinter vans or box trucks and do a delivery here and do a delivery there. I've talked to a lot of farmers. I'm fascinated with the concept that, you know, the retention rate. We have a very high retention rate of about 70%, 75%. And that's phenomenal. So that's why we've never really had to do a lot of that marketing.
Unusual.
It's very unusual. Yeah. It's very unusual. I think CSAs are more in the
40%.
So you've
got this very dedicated customer.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed a change in the customers that you're seeing back at the farmers markets that are walking around?
The urban markets, yes.
Yeah.
As DC's changed. DuPont Circle. I mean, we can use different locations that everybody might know. But that one, you know, had its core customer, and that's changed as communities change. They get gentrified, or they change just in the demographics, or the people just move out and die. Nobody buys turnips anymore, you know. And
turnips are having a hard.
They are a hard sell. But I think, you know, in some of the communities where people just show up and they want their food, they load up. They trust you. They know who you are. We share pleasantries. And they get their basket of product and they go home and we see them again next week.
Right.
We even see their grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been that kind of thing. And some of the communities, they become more fashionable hot spots, what to do while you're in town.
It's more of a, we're going to go and graze a little bit.
Get a coffee, maybe get a muffin, meet you for lunch. Yeah, buy a turnip. Yeah. So they have changed. They're becoming more and more difficult. You know, a lot of our customers are growing up and moving across the rivers now. And a lot of our customers have moved on. They're down in Boca or somewhere.
We have two incredibly articulate guests today. The conversation's gone a little longer than usual, but I know we want to get some questions, so let's do that.
I always try to give a question because Dana's my friend, so I want to spread the questions on. So for you, what is there an income differential between selling your apples and, you know, as an apple or making it juice? And for you, what is the, knowing that crops are all different, but what is your sweet spot for sun and rain? Obviously knowing the sweet spot is not this week.
We have irrigation. We prefer to see sun all the time for the most part. But it depends on if we do direct seeded crops. It's really nice to not drag sprinklers all around. For the most part, in vegetables, especially organically, any moisture from above is just a threat for disease. And it's just a breeding ground, especially with the high humidity and things we have. So we always prefer no rain, and it's a double-edged sword. People go, are you praying for rain this week? You're praying for dry. And it's like in the morning I'm praying for dry, and in the evening I'm praying for rain on those dry times to be able to work ground. I mean, we've had some seasons in summer, and to me it's just the worst procedure to, let's go irrigate bare ground so we can run tractors on it. Whereas in spring, you're always waiting for it to dry up. For the most part, I'd say I'm going to prefer dry, and we're blessed with irrigation abilities through a pond. But I have had my pond almost dry up to where it was about ankle to shin deep, and I'm out there moving my strainer and worried about snapping turtles and whatnot. But yeah, I prefer dry.
Yeah. To your question, we could go back to the Honeycrisp. I guess a lot of people understand that apple, but it's not the best example. But I will say, a good grower can probably net return to the farm $40 plus a bushel. That's just a Honeycrisp. It's a very tough apple to grow. But at the juice level, you're turning it over to the processor for $3 a bushel.
Wow.
So the disparity in not being able to finish a fruit off to its potential is pretty bizarre. It's the variance is massive. And the typical, maybe if you used something more common, a gala apple or something, you know, you could maybe be in the 12
Pink
to 30. What's that?
Pink Lady's my favorite.
Okay, we can use Pink Lady then. You know, if you grow a good Pink Lady, you can maybe bring in $18 to $20 a bushel back to yourself for a return. Bushel is about 40 pounds. But again, if you're turning it back to the juicer, current juice markets are about 8 cents. They're paying for apple right now.
8 cents
a pound. So it's not where you want to go. That's your picking cost. That's more or less your picking cost and putting wheels underneath it. And hit the reset button and try again next year. So it's not where you want to be at all. I mean, now, but then you try to find value in producing the juice, but you've also baked in a lot of cost of the capital cost of getting in the juice, the equipment, the year-round people you need, the pasteurization, the HAPs, the food safety. You know, we are chasing insane numbers, trying to make this always work out. So.
Okay. So you're both very impressive. It's it sounds like your lives are driven by public perceptions of food and availability. And is there any kind of education, anything going on anywhere to help people understand how to make decisions in this way? And
so, I mean, I can answer that to a certain degree. I mean, and I'm sure Dave will say he does it on the farm gate. We did it through, you know, Fresh Farm, which is a organization that embodies farmers markets. They have ongoing presentations and ongoing education. If you come out to a farmers market, they would greet you, meet you, let you know what's happening. USDA did a Meet the Farmer program. Nobody goes on the USDA site. I'm sure nobody's maybe ever been on one. There is some of that. You do get some of it in the spring. You do get there when there's a hype, things open back up. Mostly it's through the connection you would have with myself if you'd come out and been a customer. And I'm guessing it's probably pretty much the same for Dave when you hit his...
Do you mean the education as far as where we would receive education to...
No, we're
consumers.
It's like to get consumers to understand...
Right.
What you just explained about how apples are, mm-hmm. apples. They're apples that come because we have a stream that we need to be feeding all the time.
Right.
As a population. But we are becoming more educated. We are becoming more demanding. But we are so behind the curve on this stuff. And to do what you guys do, we need to understand.
We have an audience, so it's really interesting, and I think it's fairly inspiring because my customers spend almost $1,000 in one shot, and then they have a commitment to come to the farm, and with retention, good retention, they understand what that means. We definitely have a handful of customers that go, I probably shouldn't have done that this year. But we have an audience. And so we have a newsletter that goes out. And so I feel like they are interested, like everybody in this room right now. You guys are sitting here, like, I feel you. You're interested in what it is we're doing. And I think that's much different for maybe a really large-scale farmer, the guy who is in Yuma, Arizona, and he grows watermelons for Del Monte. And, you know, then he's going off to a packer, and it goes through five different hands before you buy it off the shelf at Giant or whatever it is. So, and I've just noticed in general just a more general interest for that. And to me, that's really inspiring. I feel like sometimes that kind of keeps me going a little bit, like you were saying at the farmers market. I worked farmers markets for years for other farms and did a lot of sales in produce. to me, that's really helpful. I had a customer just come out to me the other day because I'm having a hard time. I write the content for the newsletter, and I tend to bitch a lot, especially on a season like this. And I had a customer come up to me the other day and just tell me how thankful he was to hear what's actually going on and what's happening. And in a year like this, I can't muster a whole lot more because I put it together when I'm choosing the harvest and we're making the selection, and field crew's just going, oh, amigo, that's rotten, and amigo, that's rotten. And so it's really neat when a customer comes and says that, and they're really genuinely interested. I tend to get self-conscious about my product because I want it to be good, but I think people do care more so, and I think that that's something that is just kind of contagious a little bit, for lack of a better word. I think people are starting to get it, but I also think what Mark was saying, when you guys were first starting and they tried those strawberries, I mean – we convert people to enjoying food.
And I always say the Sun Gold, you guys know the Sun Gold cherry tomato is? I mean, it's just a little candy orange tomato. They're so delicious. You take people, go, I don't like tomatoes, and it just converts them into that. And I think that's really the big shift for this education, this desire to know. I think as animals and as creatures, we desire that pleasure that we actually get from food. It's extremely, it's not only nourishing, but there's a pleasure out of it that's really strong and related to quite a bit of things. So I think that is what's really driving that force for people to care and have value in that, let alone the health implications that are taking on, especially in this country right now. I mean, people know what that convergence is. So,
I'll ask a question.
I think you had a question in the back there.
Sorry. Hi. Dave.
Yes.
Do you think that agritourism is a good launching pad, I guess, for a farm? Is it a good way to kind of get people to come to your farm and make a name for yourself?
I do. I think it just depends on your logistics. I think every farm is so different. You know, we study this and always researching, like, what's the best way we can be more economical, we can do things. And it depends upon the kind of entrepreneurship that you're interested in. It depends upon a lot of different things. We really went down that road because we have an opportunity for that. And I found that it just wasn't the right thing for me at a particular time. I was having a lot of children, and I had a big staff, and I had a lot of things to manage. I was new to farming. I had 15 different buildings and 70 different fields and a bunch of different equipment. And it was a lot to handle. I didn't find the economic return all that great. But that was also the way I was running it at the time. And I didn't have as much land available to do those things at. I didn't have a staff as big as I needed to do those types of things. So there's a lot of different enterprises that can take place. I think agritourism is phenomenal. And I think to get people back to a connection to the farm, especially in a location like where I am, and really just this whole region in general. It's a very urban area. And I think more importantly is for the kids to be able to kind of get that type of thing. So I read a lot of stuff. I've seen a lot of farms where it's really only agritourism that has been able to keep the farm alive. And I think that's where we're seeing this epidemic of, that's a terrible word for it, or seeing this, you know, breakout in agritourism, is because growing crops is not that viable of a business anymore, and they're having to turn to that. And so it seems like a win-win, but I've talked to a lot of farmers. It's a big struggle for them to realize that their bouncy house and their little the food cart that sells the churros and the Fun Dip and the Snickers is really what's like making the money. It's not the thing. And so that's kind of a double-edged sword for those producers.
Quick question about your employees and just hiring, and just how has that been over the last few years, and retention rate for employees, and just with.
I think we suffer as much as anybody in this economy. I'm not going to millennial bash, but I will say that, you know, younger folks do have a different background coming into. So we work out of rural America. And it's getting harder and harder because more people have left rural America. Opportunities in metro and urban areas have grown, and so the traditional workforce that you relied on has left, right? We rely very heavily on the Latin community, and there's been quite a bit of immigration downward pressure in that whole environment. And that's not just us. That's the entire industry that feeds America. I think probably you can go from restaurant processing, food processors, protein. That has been very tough. It's very difficult, very challenging. We don't have anywhere in the near future robotics on our site. Like they talk about trucking industry with driverless trucks or, you know, some things that are happening. We're a very hand-based business. Getting people out into farmland is difficult for us. Fortunately, we're blessed that we do well in what we do, and we're able to return better than average wages into our our operation, but it's not the case for everybody. So it's tough. And places do shut down because of labor.
How many employees do you have?
Anywhere between 60 and 130, depending on the time of the year, what we're doing as an aggregate of several entities working together. And it's insane. I mean, it really, I don't know everybody like I used to know them all. Our core people are still there and they're still awesome. But we just don't have people pulling up the driveway anymore looking for work like we used to. We work very hard at recruiting people and retaining them, which is a new thing to do. Right. How do you retain people to work in 90-degree heat? So I don't know. Dave's probably similar.
Mostly what he said. But we're in a very urban environment, so we do have people that come down the driveway that think they want to work in 90-degree heat and think that it's a garden, and they're like, my grandfather used to grow tomatoes, and I love picking tomatoes, and I'm a hard worker, and da-da-da. It's like, cool, go hang out with the Guatemalans for, like, an hour, and let's see how it goes. And, like, after about 20 minutes, they're like, yeah, I'm good on that. And so I used to kind of believe in that, and I was like, oh, really? Cool, you want to work? Okay, great. And that doesn't work so much. So you gotta have the passion and the talent and all that.
How you doing?
Good.
So first off, thank you for sharing your stories. So in terms of agriculture and this industry, your stories are two different stories, right? But two of the same industry at two different levels. My question is about technology and some of the impact that it's played in both of your business models. So understanding that agriculture is a very hand-driven in the stories that we're talking, and what impact has that played in your business model to make you successful? And kind of like what, I would say, like what is the top technology piece that you've used to like make your business a little bit better?
So for us, it's mostly been life science, breeding, spray material. Life science companies are actively getting involved. Now, behind those companies, it's all research and development, right? That's all driven, model-driven, all the things being used in agriculture that makes the end user more efficient, how we capture data, what we get for yields, breeding, molecular breeding, and how they're able to breed faster to understand the outcomes of a plant. And that's all model-driven IT. That's very different than what we would physically do on the farm. We're the recipients of the IT that comes to us. In terms of what we do in IT, I mean, we're still sitting on the same software system that drives our timesheets, our labor, our cash flow, our balance. But what we're seeing is a benefit from people wanting, and this is a good thing. Actually, it's a great question, because what's happening in our industry is people want to eat better with less residue. So we're seeing more research in botanical design development, not GMO. I'm talking about actually changing the way plants behave through genetic selection and how you can grow them with less pesticides and residue, and how they behave post-harvest, which actually is better for consumers, it's better for the grower, and it's better for everybody in the center of the program that wants to have a decent product when they get home that eats well. There's where I see technology is part of the change in what we do. Yeah.
I think we should eat.
All right.
Extraordinary conversation from two people that really, really know their stuff. And thank you for sharing with us. Tonight's dinner was kind of inspired and cooked with Dave's produce. Nice. We got a price list, availability list that inspired Lou and I to kind of, we saw the ingredients for ratatouille on there, and so we kind of went that direction. Uh-huh. And we paired that with some leg of lamb. Lovely. And some salads, and then we have a beautiful kind of squash or essentially pumpkin pie. For dessert.
Nice.
So a beautiful supper. I'd love to continue this conversation with everyone here. Thank you for our guests for being here, Dave. Mark.
Thanks again for joining us tonight for our conversation at Artifact Coffee. With special thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Donnie Carlo for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you to them for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.